It's my honor this evening to introduce tonight's speaker. It's a gentleman that I've known for some time. If you've spent some time in these rooms and if you're successful in continuing in this program, it usually is because you develop a relationship with certain people in these programs that are an example to you in your sobriety. For me, this is one of those persons. As a young man, this guy went out to California right after he got sober, got a law degree, came back to Atlanta, started practicing law. At the same time, dived into this program, worked with other men in this program. He shares and shares honestly in meetings that I'm with him in, has a knowledge of the big book, and works the principles of the program in everyday lives and sweats over these principles and how he applies in the situations he's in. I've seen him go through difficult times, and I've seen him walk through those times with a lot of grace, with honesty, and served as a great example of me to me. So it's my pleasure to introduce Tom S., not only a guy that talks the talk, but walks the walk. So here's Tom.
My name's Tom. I'm an alcoholic. Can you guys hear me okay without this, or we need it?
Need it.
All right. Sounds like I'm not the first one to try that. Troy, thank you. I appreciate it. That sounds like enough. Firstly, I had not heard that reading just before Troy introduced me. It sounds like that's more of a disclaimer to say, like, if this guy sucks, don't worry. This thing's cool. Stick around. I'll be honest with you. I have no desire to be up here whatsoever. Tim asked me some time ago, over 6 months ago, to come up here and tell my story. And I hemmed and hawed and talked to my sponsor, my wife, and they all said, go do it. And I didn't want to. I get to talk in public quite a bit. Troy gave away some of my story that I'm an attorney, and I get to talk in front of judges, in front of boards of directors, and all kinds of fun stuff. But in front of you people, I don't like talking. I don't share in meetings unless, you know, I feel some urgent sense of obligation. I need to go out and say something. But I don't like talking in front of groups of people in AA. When I'm out in the world and get to share, or when I get to speak, I know what I'm talking about. It has nothing to do with me, and it's not as if I have to convince the people that I'm a good person or anything else. I don't like talking about in front of you people because you guys know me, and I can't bullshit you guys. Can I swear?
Sure.
Good. I'll try to keep it at a minimum, but it slips. Thank you. So with that disclaimer of not wanting to be up here, I've avoided this for 9.5 years now, and this is the first time I've told my story. So hopefully that properly lowers any expectations, and I can get through this in 45 minutes and maybe give some sort of insight into how it works. So with that said, my story, there's nothing really glamorous about it. My drunkalog, I'm not going to really get into. You know, I've talked to you people, and your stories are a hell of a lot better than mine, and that's not what we say is my core competency. I know that my story's really, in looking back across my life, you know, it's all the same. Every day was the same thing. You know, I thought it was exciting. I tried to romanticize what I did in my life because, frankly, I couldn't control what the hell I was doing. I hated myself and hated my life, and so I tried to have this idea I was living like a rock star, and therefore it was all cool, because that was always important for me as a young kid, was to be cool. But today, you know, it was boring. You know, if you look back at what I did on a day-to-day basis, nothing ever really changed. So again, I'm not going to spend a hell of a lot of time talking about what it was like. I know I'm charged with telling you guys what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. I'm going to tell you a little bit about myself and my history to give you a little bit of idea of who I am, but not a hell of a lot about what I did as a drunk. Instead, I'm going to try to take a couple stories from my life and try to make it illustrate what AA did for me. And that's why I'm here today. It's because of AA. For no other reason, it's because of AA that I stand here today in front of you guys with 9.5 years sober on Saturday. So with that said, I never had any reason to drink. I had a good family. I had good parents. There was no abuse. There was no neglect. I wasn't beaten. I wasn't screamed at. I wasn't yelled at. I had two loving parents that provided my sister and I everything they possibly could. We certainly were not wealthy by any stretch of the imagination, but they did what they could. You know, my parents were self-sacrificing to give my sister and I a better life. I know a lot of people in these rooms who had reasons to drink, and I'm not one of them. I had no reason. I was born on May 22, 1976, in Dayton, Ohio. I was the second of two children. I have a sister who's 2 years older than me. Shortly after I was born, we moved to Rochester, New York. Lived there until 1983, when I was 7 or 8 years old, and we moved to Atlanta. Relocated in Atlanta following my dad's job. He worked with GM. I moved to Marietta. I went to Lasseter High School. Spent most of the last, whatever 83 minus 2010 is, there. Spent a couple years in California, as Troy mentioned, but Atlanta's my home. That's where I grew up. When we moved to Atlanta, that's when a lot of my memories started. I remember New York to some extent, but Atlanta's really, it's really where I grew up. And looking back at my childhood, yeah, again, my childhood was as perfect of a childhood as you can possibly imagine. I got here, and as part of all kids, when you come in, you have to take these standardized tests. Took these tests. I placed well on them. Got put in gifted programs. Was taking math classes a couple years ahead of my age, and did really well in school. And none of that was for me. You know, I believe that God gave me a natural predisposition to alcoholism. I believe that. I also believe whatever I was born with on top of my head was nothing that I earned. And during my childhood, what that did for me, doing well in school, is it let me get away with a lot of stuff. Also important is that my parents loved it. They'd look at their son and they'd be proud, and I latched on to that. When I'd come home and tell my parents I did this or that, and again, I didn't do anything, I just went there and did what I was told. Seeing my mom and my dad gleam with his pride, God, that was just like cocaine. I mean, it was amazing. I latched onto that. I love to see my parents filled with pride, and that became such a part of who I became over the next 20 years. But it started back then. I also started playing sports when I came here to Atlanta. I was a stand-up baseball player. Played football, basketball, and tennis as well. Again, you know, I like sports, and that was much of my identity during that time frame. But going back to my childhood and what it was like, you know, I can't complain. It was great, you know. Again, my parents weren't wealthy, but they did well enough to take us to many places around the country. We traveled a lot. They ended up buying a boat, and we had a house on Lake Lanier, and we spent the summers, you know, up at the lake and traveling. And they took us to church. Church was a periodic thing for us. My dad was Southern Baptist growing up. He's from Atlanta. Mom was Methodist. We went Methodist. And I did that until I was 13. I guess at 13 you get confirmed, and that was church for me. Then shit hit the fan. For me personally and emotionally, when I hit puberty, I just got steamrolled. I went from being in middle school. In middle school, I was this class clown, and I did well in school and sports, and my conduct grades were terrible because I always had to be the center of attention, and I was always goofing off. Then I got away with it. Again, my parents are proud because of the grades and this and that, and I got away with all this crap, and things are great. At high school, I went from a class of 300 to 3,000. I got a face full of zits. My self-confidence was shot, put on weight, and I was miserable. I just retreated. You know, I was this boisterous, outgoing kid before I hit puberty. And all those forces came together, and I was a mess. I was such an isolationist, and such, I was so scared of everything. I was scared of life. I was scared of people. I was scared of girls. I was scared of talking to anybody. Sure as hell, I was certainly scared of talking in public, and, you know, this is my freshman year of high school, and about that time I started drinking. And when I found booze brought me back. It's whatever carelessness and reckless abandon I had when I was in middle school and elementary school, that booze, when I had it in me, it brought me back to that place if I just didn't care and I could live. And it was so liberating for me to drink. When I was in high school, I went to high school in 1990, 1991. At that time, this band called Nirvana came out, and Nirvana released their album called Nevermind. Well, Nevermind in grunge music was what I classify as neo-existentialism. And what I mean by that is that if you listen to what Nirvana said, and when I was 13, 14 years old, it was very impressionable, and think what you want about how music affects kids, but me, it affected me. I latched onto that. I looked at what Nirvana sang about, and the bands like Nirvana, Pearl Jam, all these other bands, and essentially it was, life sucks. There's no reason to be here. There is no God. And fuck everything. And fuck me. And that's what it was all about. And in being popular in high school was everything to me. Being popular was everything. And so getting into this music and hating the world, I latched onto that. The other type of music that came out at the time was gangster rap. And I still love gangster rap. But the part of gangster rap that folds into that is that they didn't give a shit about anything. The whole world was more or less against the guys who rapped. They hated order, they hated police, they hated any sort of establishment because they got screwed. And me, this little white kid, skinny white kid from East Cobb, thought like, yeah, you know. Uh-huh. So hate the world, drink, act hard, and, you know, screw everything. And again, I had these grades in sports and the shit behind it. So through high school, I just floated. And I got through all that, and I just did what I wanted. But I've been told this by psychologists that when you start drinking at a young age, your emotional maturity stops. I'm convinced that for at least this alcoholic, that's true. Because at 13, 14 years old, well, I just stopped. You know, if I ever came across any sort of hard situation, I knew the answer. You know, and I started drinking alcoholically probably at 14 years old, which would have been my freshman year. It was my first buzz. My first buzz. Summer 7th grade, I'm on the playground with my buddy John Green. John Green and I go to the playground, and we're too old to be on the swings, but he brandishes a big tin of Copenhagen. So we pack our mouths full of this minty-smelling worm dirt, and we're swinging on the swings, and the air's rushing, we're kicking and pulling, and I drop my head back. And that tobacco hits my head, and it is euphoria. And I remember that as clear as day. And that feeling, I mean, it wasn't alcohol, it wasn't drugs, it was tobacco. But that feeling is what I was addicted to, you know. I'm an alcoholic, I'm an addict, I don't really call myself an addict much, but I am. You know, I was addicted, I guess, to alcohol. I was, screw the science for a minute. I was addicted to the feeling that alcohol produced and not alcohol itself. So that's my opinion, it's not science, but that's the way that I see it for me. When I got into high school and I couldn't talk to, you know, the mirror without getting scared, I found booze and then it lightened everything up. And that's what I did. I have a bit of a script here. I saw another friend of mine sitting over there do this once upon a time. And he's a lot more charismatic and entertaining than me. So, you know, I had a buddy of mine on my football team in high school, and this guy lived across the street. And I'm sure he's doing really well for himself right now. But when we were freshman, sophomore in high school, he told me that he had found God. And I didn't tell him this, but I thought, I found alcohol. I did, because alcohol was my God. And it got me through everything. I would just drink. I'd go to parties. I didn't give a shit about anything. Kids loved me because I just didn't care. I mean, I was blacked out half the time, so who knows what I was doing. And that was life. Another important thing that happened when I was in high school is that, again, I told you I was raised Christian, kind of, in the Methodist church. You know, I went through the motions, didn't really get into it. In history, I was in this advanced history class. It was about world history, and there was one section that focused on religion. And I learned that the stories that I was told in the Bible when I was a kid actually existed in religions that pre-existed Judaism. Well, then, so you're telling me it's all made up. It's all bullshit. And I was also introduced into the concept in English classes of existentialism. Again, it's a stupid big word, but essentially it goes to the fact of that there is no God, life's not important, and fuck it, I'm going to do whatever I want anyway. And that's where I was, and that was my mentality. That's a nutshell of what my life looked like growing up, to the point where I stopped maturing. That's where I was. Now, again, I told you I wasn't going to get into a hell of a lot of what I did when I was drinking, the drunk log stories. I did create a little list, bullet point number 7, called Consequences of Drinking, also known as Stupid Shit Tom Did When He Was Drunk. December 91, I was arrested for public intoxication and minor possession. February of 91, I quit baseball to drink. I told you I was a standout baseball player. I threw it away. Just threw it away. Survived most of high school without getting in a hell of a lot of trouble. Graduated in 94. In January of 1995, I had made it to Georgia Tech. I failed out of Georgia Tech with a cumulative GPA of 0.86. In November of 95, I was arrested for minor possession. In April of 96, I was arrested for probation violation and a minor possession, and this was the day of my sister's wedding. My family got to tell the family why Tom was not going to be at the wedding that night because he was in jail. Fortunately, I sobered up and got out and got through it. April 97, arrested for DUI, minor possession. The police did not care for the fact that I was taking Highway 9 east to go west. In May of 1998, I failed out of Auburn University. I'd already failed out of Tech once, and then I went to another school, and then Auburn failed out of there. That was in May of 98. In June of 98, I fraudulently misrepresented my grades to get back into Georgia Tech. In August of 98, 3 months later, I failed out of Georgia Tech the second time. D never really found out about the fraudulent misrepresentation, just threw me out anyway. March 1999, I got fired from stealing for work the first time. April of 1999, I fell asleep at the wheel on Interstate 85 and I totaled a car. July of 2000, I got my second DUI. I blew a .234 and I was sentenced to jail and rehab. In March 2001, I was put on academic suspension from Georgia State University. Now that are the low points of my drinking career. The other crap that's in there, but that's kind of give you a backfill of what drinking did for me. A lot of bad stuff. In April of 2001, I was a complete train wreck. I had nothing in me. At that point, I was working for my mom, which meant I was employed, but I was unemployable working for my mom. I lived in my parents' basement because I'd proven that I couldn't live out on my own. I'd been kicked out of apartments for not being able to pay rent. During that time frame, as I was working at this restaurant, stealing, $1,000 a week, me and my buddy, who now is in this program with me, were working at this restaurant, Fridays at North Point, and we were just stealing like dogs. We'd put our heads together, he's a pretty bright guy, and figure out how to manipulate a computer system, and just stole from work. I hold myself up as an honest guy. I did. But at that point, I was stealing from work, and I couldn't survive on my own, so I was in my parents' basement. I had the wherewithal, maybe a moment of clarity once upon a time, that in those days where I didn't go get a credit card because I knew what would happen. If I got a credit card, it would have been ugly. So with no bills, I was in my parents' basement getting paid at a job I shouldn't have had because I was not qualified. I might have been qualified intellectually, but I was a piece of shit. I was worthless. They didn't need me at that job. And again, I was absolutely desperate. A year before I got sober, I surrendered to alcohol. I say that I surrendered because what to me that meant is I knew that there's no way. When I wake up in the morning and I tell myself I'm not going to drink, that is a lie. Because I know there's no way in hell I'll ever live up to it. So I surrendered. I said, fuck it. Because what I'd learned before that is when I woke up in the morning and said, you know what, today I'm not doing it. And I knew that. I meant it. When I woke up in the morning, I knew that I would not drink that night. And then, 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock in the afternoon, the thought would pop in my head. And when that thought hit my head, it was over. As soon as the thought of drinking went in my head, it was a predetermined conclusion that I'd be drinking that night. And so I just gave up. I just succumbed to the fact that I was going to go ahead and drink. I made a pact with myself that I was going to put myself on a collision course with destruction. I was so miserable and so broken up inside that I decided I was going to drink myself, not to death, because I was too scared to ever kill myself, although I thought about it a lot, but I was going to drink until I don't know, until I just completely self-destructed, maybe get thrown in rehab. I don't know, but I was gonna do something. That's the only option I had. I couldn't stop the thing, so why not go with it? And this thing, at least temporarily takes away the angst and the pain and everything else I was feeling, so I just went with it. And again, I was completely desperate. You know, I was just saturated with self-loathing and self-hatred and shame of what, you know, I could have been and didn't do. You know, I thought this, I've never said it in a meeting, but to me, I was in a state of abject despondency. Those big fancy words for what Bill Wilson, and he says it better than me, calls spiritually and morally bankrupt. And it's such a telling. I love that line. I love the big book and the way it's written. I write a lot for work, and I'm into it, and God, it's such a poetic phrase, saying that spiritually and morally bankrupt. Describe me. I had nothing left in me. I could try to throw some other big words out there, but I think most everyone in here knows what that is, and it's bottom. You know, I had hit bottom. I was absolutely done. There's nothing else I could give. I tried quitting on my own several different times. At one point, I had gotten 3 months of sobriety on my own, but all along, I was smoking weed. And, you know, you can't black out from smoking weed. And if you can't black out, you know, it doesn't take away the pain. And at the end of that time frame, I started doing acid again. And, you know, trying to be sober and smoking weed and doing acid led to cocaine and booze. And, you know, it didn't work. But that time frame when I was trying to stay sober on my own was lonelier than it was, you know, beforehand. I mean, it's as lonely as I've ever been. The longest I've ever been is trying to drink on my own without God, without this program, and still taking mind-altering substances. It's misery. So that was bottom. I stayed in bottom for some time. I don't know if it was a full year, but it was bottom for quite some time. At that time frame, because of the second DUI, I had a breathalyzer put on my car. And that breathalyzer meant that I could only drink a certain amount at night before I had to wake up in the morning and go to work. Fired for not showing up. And so I had this outpatient rehab I had to go to from, you know, the DUI that was on Thursday nights. And to illustrate where I was mentally with drinking, and what a grip it had on my life. On Thursday nights, I had this outpatient rehab from like 6 o'clock at night till 9 o'clock at night. And what I would do is I'd leave work early, and I'd hit the liquor store on the way to rehab. And the reason I did this is it was a time thing. So I didn't want to waste time leaving rehab at 9 o'clock to stop at the liquor store, because I knew once I got home, I could only drink so much and have enough time to metabolize the alcohol and be able to blow on that thing and go to work and not get fired. And yeah, that's where I was. And I was there for a year before getting sober. And you know, that was done. So, April 15th, 2001, it's tax day. So it was tax day because at the time I was working as an accountant at my mom's office. And tax day is a Friday, which was tax day, April 15th. All the accounts work really hard up to the 15th of April. And then you take it easy. So on April 15th, I was going to leave work early, and we were hitting the bar. And I convinced my mom to go, despite all my shit in the past. Convinced her to go, and some other people to go, and she didn't want to get out of there fast enough, and she was going to drive me up there because I couldn't drive, and I ended up yelling at her and then having somebody pick me up at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So we could get hammered because the tax season was over. Now, this being said, I was a general ledger accountant, not a tax accountant. So what that means is that the tax day was completely inapplicable to me. It had nothing. It was just an excuse to go out and get wasted. Then that night, I went out, got obliterated, parents left. I ended up at some other bar, and after about 10 o'clock at night, I was blacked out. And I don't remember anything of that night except for one key piece. Evidently, at some point, I called my sister and said, "Hey, come meet us out." And my sister met us out at some bar, and it was hand in hand in Virginia Highlands. No idea how I got there, because I'd started in Sandy Springs. But I remember talking to my sister. Her name's Carrie. And told Carrie, you know, I got this problem. And she looked at me, and she's like, "Tom, I know. You know, we all know." And I was shocked. You know, I could not believe that. I mean, this is my secret. No one knew what was going inside my head. No one had any idea that this thing I've been hiding for 10 years. And she's like, yeah, Tom, we know. Yeah. I remember that part. So the next morning, I somehow made it home, and I was, my girlfriend at the time lived in my parents' basement. I was in my parents' basement. She spent the night. And my parents called me up, and they sat me down, and they said, Tom, you know, I don't remember anything. The only thing I remember is they said, at one point, do you have a problem? And I said, yes. I'd been asked that question before by them, and, you know, I'd always say no, because if I were to say yes, I knew that that would mean I'd have to quit, and alcohol is the only thing, and drugs and other shit, but alcohol mainly, was the only thing that would take away that pain of who I'd become, and by saying yes, that was a commitment. And I don't, it wasn't me speaking. You know, it was definitely something spiritual. And it just came out. And I said yes. And that, there was a physical lifting. I felt 50 pounds lighter. It was unbelievable. You know, you hear about bright light things in the book and this and that. If I ever had one in one of those situations, that was it. Because it's just like that terrible, dark down secret. And that was the worst secret I had, was my alcoholism. It just went away. And from that time point on, I don't say I never had cravings and that I was relieved of the obsession at that point, but it was pretty damn close. 4 days later, I went into AA, got a white chip, went to 8111. That was my home group for the first few years. Within the first week, I got a sponsor. An important part of that, you know, when I got sober, because of what I'd read and this whole thing with the church and Christianity, I probably had one foot in atheism and another foot in agnosticism when I got sober. And my first sponsor was a non-practicing Jew who never mentioned the word Jesus. And that was critical for me because, I don't know, maybe I was so screwed up that maybe my bottom was such at the bottom, it didn't matter what the hell was said, I would have gotten through and been okay, but I don't know. I'm really glad that I didn't have to adopt the religion when I came into AA. Because I don't know if I would have made it or not. I did, and you know, thank God that's how it was. But my first sponsor turned me on to a Wednesday night men's meeting. I've got, you know, my crew over here in the peanut gallery, and got others spread out through here that I've known these guys since I got sober. That was, because my last drunk was April 15th, 2001. April 16th, I had to finish off my weed, of course, and so I got high that night. But I call April 16th my sobriety day, and that was it. When I got into the program, we went through the first three steps. My sponsor allowed me to, as far as the third step, I told him, I don't know if I said this directly because I was too scared to say something like this, but really, I didn't really want to touch the God stuff, but I did know that as miserable as I was, I would have done anything. If they said I had to believe in Jesus, I probably would have done it. But I didn't have to, and I'm glad that that didn't come up. So my third step, I went skydiving when I was like 2 months sober, and he said, okay, that's your third step. So, okay. I can deal with that. That works. The next part, I mentioned that there was one of the times that I really felt a physical lifting, or white light, or burning bush, whatever the hell you want to call it, and that was when I did my first, fourth, and fifth step. I had these secrets that I thought were so terrible. And I spent so much time in the fourth step. I spent probably a month and a half or so, and I'm sure you guys have done longer, but I spent a long time in that fourth step and put everything I could possibly think of, because I was scared shitless. If I didn't put everything on that fourth step, that I was going to end up drunk. You know, there's some feeling I had of the sinners in the hands of angry God. If I don't do everything in this book, then I'm going to end up drunk again, and I cannot be there, so I'll do it. So I spent all this time in the fourth and fifth step, and I went and sat down I met with my sponsor. His name was Eric. And he said, okay, and I whip out this, you know, this like law book, and I drop it on this on the countertop. I'm ready to go. I'm nervous as hell, scared shitless, and he tells me, he says, "Tom, that's for you." I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, that fourth step, that's for you. I want to know what your worst three sins are." I don't know what the hell he called it, but it was like the worst three things that were on that list I had to tell him. And so we got through there, and I told him, and he laughed at me, and that pissed me off. That's the only thing he's been on probably every fourth step I've done since then. But and he kind of laughed at me, and he was like, "Is that it?" And I said, "Well, yeah." And he's like, "Well, I want you to take that fourth step, and I want you to go burn it somewhere." So at the time, I was living in Roswell, and I went down to the Chattahoochee, and there's some shoals over on Riverside Road, and I walked out into the shoals, and it was late at night. I burnt that thing. And again, that was spiritual of what I went through in doing that, and the physical lifting of getting through that, because again, the secrets that I had, these goddamn secrets that I had that just... I was disgusted with myself and everything I did, and holding those secrets was such a dirty thing, and getting rid of them was phenomenal. So I went through the steps. Went through in about 9 or 10 months. I don't really remember. And it's been night and day. I mean, my life today compared to what it was, Jesus Christ. You know, one of the important parts of my story, two main stories I like to tell, and I'll run out of time. It's my dad. You know, my dad was a selfless guy. He didn't swear, he didn't drink, he didn't smoke. He did everything he could for his family. And I put my dad on a pedestal. I looked up to my dad. Well, during my drinking career, especially about the last 5 years, we didn't talk. You know, I felt as if that this man that I respected the most just hated me, you know, because I was worthless. And it was all internal. I mean, it was all projection. And he just, you know, in retrospect, he just wanted me to be happy. But we didn't get along. We not physically, but we fought. I got thrown out of the house a couple times. He said, "You can't kick me out. I'm leaving. You know, well, you can't find me. I quit shit." You know, stupid stuff. But our relationship was all but destroyed, you know. And for between a son and a father, I guess half you guys are here, man. You know what I'm talking about. There's a bizarre, unbelievably cool chemistry about a dad and a father, and this man that I so much wanted to be, you know, I thought he hated me. And when I got sober, it would have been summer of 2002. My grandfather's health started going bad, and so my dad's dad, obviously. And at that time, I was sober about a year and a half. And my dad, right before I got sober, didn't talk to me for 5 years, and we didn't speak to one another except for the sake of my mother. We'd be cordial at most. You know, I got to be there with my dad when his dad was dying. And when my dad, or when my grandfather died, my dad asked me to give the eulogy. And that was so important to me that he would ask me to give the speech to commemorate his own father. And I spent a lot of time on it. A hell of a lot more time than I spent preparing to speak tonight. But I gave it. I gave the eulogy, and my family was there, and my dad was in the front row. And as I left, my dad stood up, and it's the only time I've seen him cry. He's crying and gives me a hug. And he tells me he's proud of me. And that, Jesus Christ. I would have done everything just for that. Everything I did in A to get sober, I would have done for that moment. That was a gift. So this story I'm going to tell is about a girl named Abby. Man, it was a girl I met when I was working at a restaurant in about 2002, about the same time frame. I was married at the time to that ex-girlfriend, and that was a codependent relationship. I got sober, things got better for me, and it fell apart. I'm still friends with her. I talked to her a few months ago. But at the time that I met Abby, I was still married, and at that point, I was practicing these principles in my affairs, and I was honest, and I was enamored with this girl, but I didn't do anything, and would not have. About a year later, I got divorced, and the first date that my divorce was finalized and signed, the judge stamped off on, I went out with Abby. That was my first date after divorce, and I thought I was crazy about this girl. And at the time, she was 6 years younger than me. I was 27, 26. She was 20, and she was at Georgia Tech, real smart girl, but she drank a lot. She's a party girl. And I thought, well, I'm moving out to San Diego in a month to go start law school, and I've been with the same girl for 6 years. I'll have fun. And I did. And I thought it was going to be over, and that was going to be it. That I would just meet this girl, we'd have a lot of fun, and then I'd go out to law school in California, two years sober at that point, and I'd be in California, and hell, I was in Southern California. If you haven't been to San Diego, it's a lovely place. There's a lot of lovely women in San Diego, and I thought that would be my destiny. So this thing I had with this girl named Abby was more than just an infatuation. It turned out more than just a stupid boyhood type crush deal. And we really hit it off. We had a lot in common. The funny thing is that how we really knew we had a lot in common is that we were at work one day and we started telling pissing stories. She'd tell me stories about being drunk and peeing in the middle of a room in the middle of college, and I'd tell her about peeing on my ex-girlfriend's roommate while she was in bed underneath the covers, and we bonded. This is stuff, this is good stuff here. But we stayed together, and we did the long distance thing for about a year. That summer I came back and worked for a judge. I came back to Atlanta from San Diego after my first year and worked for a judge downtown, and I lived with her while here, and by the end of that year I was done. I was like, I couldn't take it. It was like this relationship where the first 3 or 4 days was glorious, and like after 3 or 4 days, I mean, her drinking, I was just like, this is insane. I knew she was drunk after. I probably knew she was a drunk when, before we started meeting, but I wasn't going to tell myself that. It was just a fling, whatever. So, after being together about a year, I went back to San Diego to start school back up in September. I had a shitty day, a terrible day. A car broke down, got in a fight with the guy trying to, the mechanic, and I thought he was trying to hose me and this and that. So I call her thinking, this is part of the way. I wanted to vent. That's part of why we couple up and get together, so you have somebody to vent. And I called her to vent, and it was noon there, it would have been 3 o'clock here, and she is just wasted. And that was it. I was done. That was the final straw where I made a decision that night that I was breaking it off, and I was done. I came to the point where I was walking back home from where I was because I didn't have a car. I thought about, started envisioning all the different possibilities. Well, I'll meet a girl here in San Diego. We'll get married up and wherever. And so I was done. I'd already moved on past that. She had told me for some time that she was going to get sober. And I'm saying bullshit. I met her mom. Her mom was a total drunk, drinking for 30, 40 years. It ain't going to happen. She's not getting sober. I'd been in the rooms long enough to know then that not everybody who gets sober or says they're going to get sober stays sober, and I didn't believe it, and she didn't try. But that night, when I made the decision that I was going to break it off, I got an email from her early in the morning that said, I went to my first meeting, we need to talk. And I thought, nah, there's no way. Somehow she found out what I had decided, even though we hadn't talked. She found out, and it was another bullshit con game to try to mess it. I didn't believe it, but a day turned into a week, turned into a month, turned into a year, and she was still sober. Now, she got sober here in Atlanta, and I was out in San Diego. If I would have been living here and she was trying to get sober, it never would have worked. Because I would have thought it would have been for me, and it just wouldn't have worked. If she had moved out to California and tried to get sober, I wouldn't let her move out. She had hinted about moving out before she got sober. I said, no, I don't want to do that. But she got sober, and it worked. And there's no way that I could have envisioned or planned out or taken the reins from God and figure out how to make this fucking thing work. And it did. You know, despite my decision to end it and despite what I thought needed to happen, it went a different course and it worked. She's been sober now for 6 years. She picked up 6 years in August. And it's an amazing thing. You know, I think God had a sense of humor when he put me with her, because she is an amazing woman, and she is a piece of work. I love her to death. You know, we've been trying to have kids for 2 years, and it hasn't worked. You know, not everything that I want to have happen in life happens. We've struggled with it, been to counseling, and been to doctors, and this and that. And everything's worked out the way that I wanted it to. But that's it. You know, another thing that happened a couple years back is a friend of mine named Pete from high school. Pete and I went to high school together, we went to college together, we went to Auburn, we drank together. I failed out, he didn't. Pete and I drank, like, we talked about being alcoholic and how we used to drink back when we were 20 years old. And he told me he had a problem back when he was 20, and I had a problem too. I knew damn well at that time that's what I was. Pete called me in the summer of 2008 and said, "Tom, it's Pete." And I said, "Oh, great." Well, Pete's one of four brothers and a sister, and his brother had OD'd on heroin 10 years beforehand, or 8 years beforehand. And Pete called me and told me that he was going to try to stop drinking, that he'd been in and out of rehab a couple different times, and he wanted to know if I'd sponsor him. And I was floored. You know, you got a guy from the past ask you to sponsor him, and he wants to get sober. I thought it was fantastic, and I was thrilled. You know, I was like a little kid. And I got a sponsor, or a sponsee rather, and you know, we drank together, and he's going to be my my buddy and my project and this and that, and you know, and it was cool. Well, Pete got sober, stayed sober for about a month and a half. Went back out, and Pete drank, like, geez, I thought I drank a lot. Nowhere close, you know. Pete was a guy who would drink liquor all day long. And, again, he's a very functional guy. Did well, had his own business construction company. Did well for himself. He was drinking himself to death. And got sober about 3 months. And then he was out in about December or so of 2008. Hadn't heard from him for weeks. I figured he's back out drinking again. I was disappointed, but I got a call from another friend of ours named Andy, and Andy said, "Tom, Pete's dead." And Pete was 31, and he died. And the autopsy came back inconclusive. They had to send his body off to the coroner. The coroner came back and said that he died of acute alcohol poisoning and chronic alcoholism. That's what the doctor said. That's the only thing they could point. They have no idea why this kid died. They say alcoholism. Well, alcohol is pretty broad. My mom's mom died of an alcohol-related death when she was 36, but they knew it was a penicillin reaction because the body was so destroyed from the years of drinking. Pete, they couldn't figure out what the hell it was, so they just said, "Nice, chronic alcoholism, acute alcohol poisoning." And that's what it does to if that could happen to me, if I decide I can go back out and drink again. And it's a terrible story. And, you know, he's the second guy I went to high school with and played sports with who's died from alcoholism. The guy put a gun in his mouth and blew his head off. I know a lot of people died, but you know, that's not necessarily an opener. You know, I gave you a list of stupid shit Tom did when he was drunk, and those are my consequences of drinking. And talking about some of the consequences of sobriety. Got sober in April 2001, as I mentioned. I went back to school in the summer of 2001. Again, after 7 years of undergrad and a semester shy of a two-year degree, I went back to school. And in a year and a half, I finished college. I had a 4.0 that entire time. I mean, life's just so much different when you're sober. In April 2003, got accepted to law school. 2003 to 2005, I finished law school. Did that in 2.5 years. Was top, you know, top quarter of my class. Passed the bar. Got my first job at a law firm. So I mentioned in November of 2000. I didn't mention this, but in November 2007, my lovely wife, Abby, and I got married, which was fantastic. in May of 2008. We bought a house. It's our second house, but not in the ghetto this time, which was nice. In 2008, we got this bad economic thing going on, and I took a leap of faith and trusted in my higher power to quit a job that I knew I couldn't stay at because it was destroying my consciousness because what was occurring at that law firm was unethical. I said, fuck it. And I walked. And I left that law firm, and I mean, in the worst part of this great recession, they call it, that we're in, you know, at the end of 2008. So in 2009, I started my law firm, and that's had its ups and downs. Life is fantastic, but it's been challenging. It means a lot of work, but it's okay. It's good. You know, this thing I've had with religion and the church, you know, I've battled it. I've gone so many different places with trying to find a higher power that I could believe in, and trying to just dispel all these old prejudices that I had had. It's come full circle. In AA, we talk about finding the people that have what we want and hanging out with those people. Well, my wife and I, our closest friends, are not alcoholic, but they're Catholics. And it's the two of them and their five kids, and these people are amazing. And I never wanted to go back to church. I mean, part of the luxury of, I think I'm stealing this from a comedian, but part of the luxury of atheism is you don't have to go to church. You know, I don't do that. And next week I'm meeting with a priest to field some of my stupid philosophical questions, and I'm willing to give it a shot because I see this family and I see the joy and the love and the utter peace and contentment these people have, and for that I'm willing to at least give it a shot. My wife has warned me, she's kind of an extremist, and she's warned me that I better be prepared because this is Catholicism, this is not some stupid Methodist church, and when she jumps in, she jumps in with both feet, and better be prepared for what's going to happen. But anyhow, that's next week. But I told you we've been trying to have a kid, and tomorrow morning we meet with the doctor, and we're going to look at the first sonogram of our kid. Means I might be a dad. That's a cool thing. Thank you. But you know, I just have a beautiful life. It's amazing what AA has done for me. You know, I'm not a piece of shit. I'm not worthless. I'm accountable. I'm reliable. You know, I have people who entrust their companies to my protection. That's what I do. I'm a corporate lawyer, and to have people put the faith in me to you know, go to bat for them and actually take my advice, and it's amazing. More importantly, I've got amazing relationships with all my family. I'm so close with all of them. 3 months after Abby got sober, her mom got sober. So her mom's coming up on 6 years. And in February, Abby's younger sister will have 2 years of sobriety. I don't know that her dad's going to come into the picture. I don't know if he's one of us. So I'll settle for the hat trick over the sweep. But you know, more importantly, I intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle me. You know, I intuitively know right from wrong, and you know, in the deepest part of my soul, I know there's a God that looks after me and my family. Thank you.
Sharing the message and not the mess. Very, very enlightening, and I got a lot out of it. I'm sure many of us did. We're passing the baskets, been passing them for a little while. The seventh tradition states that there are no dues or fees for AA membership, but your generous contributions support this group in AA's zone. And it's time for the chips. And Bill, could you hand out the chips?
Everybody, I'm Bill. I'm an alcoholic. White chip is for enjoying our way of life one day at a time. So I want a white chip. For 30 days, we give a silver chip. Wow. Anybody else for silver? The red chip is for 90 days. Anybody have 90 days? Yellow, 6 months. Green for 9 months. And blue for year or multiple of years. Okay, congratulations on the chip shop.
Thank you, Bill. In case anybody changes their mind on the white chip, it's right here. And it's time for AA-related announcements. Yes, Mark.
My name is Mark. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Mark.
And the Kids and Vince Academy has been more like an AA literature scene after me.
Okay. Now, Nava's got a Halloween dance coming up on the 30th, 9:30 in this room, right after the 12 and 12 meeting that's at 8 o'clock. In the back room area there. Nava always has a great Halloween dance, so please come. This weekend in Athens is the 57th prepaid AA convention for this district, and meaning is free. It's no cost, right? Wayne, you know much about it? Okay. Well, anyway, I registered last Thursday, and you can still go online. Go to aageorgia.org, and you can register. And it's a full weekend with speakers coming from all over to celebrate and work on sobriety in Athens, Georgia. So there's more information on the web for that. Next week, we've got Mark L. telling his story. And the week after that, Vernita P. So we got a great lineup, and hope to see you again next week. And I'd like to remind everybody that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions. Never mind us place principles for personalities, and for those who will, please join us in the Lord's Prayer.
Yeah, I know. I went to a quick workshop.
Yeah. Sorry. Are you ready? Who always makes a great meeting?
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and glory forever and ever. Amen.
You come back and work to work.
It works.